This is an ABC podcast.
Live across Victoria.
On ABC Listen.
Your smart speaker.
And on your radio.
This is 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
The conversations that are important to you.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Hello. This hour, you're going to meet a man who missed a bus. That moment changed his life, and what he did next could change yours, at least a little bit. He's built an app so that you can hail a bus, let them know you're there in real time. Have you ever missed a bus at the possibly the worst time? You're standing there in the dark. You don't want to miss it. You're juggling a pram and bags and kids, or you're vision impaired, like my next guest. I'm Mary Guerin, and in the Conversation Hour, I'd love for you to tell me just how well accessibility is working for you on public transport. And I'm going to introduce you to this young man. He came from Colombia to Australia at 12 without a word of English, and he's now 26, the first blind electrical engineering student in the Southern Hemisphere. He's made an app called Hailo, H-A-I-L-O, and that's been trialled here on buses in Victoria. It's to help people with vision impairment, but also potentially many others. You'll meet him. Maybe you can ask him what he's doing next and tell him what app he should be building next when it comes to accessibility. I'd love to hear your stories. How accessible is public transport for you? Also, we've been looking at this because a listener emailed us to say we should be looking at it. So if you have anything to say about vision impairment, how what you think that the rest of us should know about, 1300 222 774 is the number to call. Also this hour, I can't believe we need to talk about this again. Another wave of shortages in HRT patches. We've heard that women are cutting their patches in half and travelling interstate to fill scripts. Is that you? Let me know. Later this hour, we're going to check in to see what's going on, what's behind this shortage now, what alternatives you might consider. Also today, the Melbourne Vixens, the netball club, of course, are breaking membership records. But how healthy is Australian netball? We'll be looking into that. And also, you might have heard some breaking news over the past few hours. The US president announced Project Freedom. That's the project that's supposed to open the Strait of Hormuz, is paused, but the blockade remains. If you're confused, you're not alone. We will unpick that. But first, let's meet the man who built an app that could change the way we all catch buses.
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
It's 8 minutes past 11. I do want to talk about vision impairment more generally in response to an email that we got. Let's talk about it. What are the issues for you if you are vision impaired? Is it public transport? Is it something else? What should we know? 1300 222 774. Well, the person I'm about to interview now has had a problem. He couldn't get a bus, and that changed the way he saw things and how now, as a result of that, he's made an app that is being trialled right now in Victoria. Santiago Velasquez joins me now. Thanks for joining me, Santiago.
No, Mary, thank you very much for having me, and really appreciate that even a listener of yours is talking about some of the, hurdles that people with disabilities and without have when using public transport.
Absolutely. Very soon we are going to be talking to Chris Edwards from Vision Australia, who can give us sort of a bit more of an overview. But let's talk about you first and this app. You came from Colombia at 12, as I've read, not a word of English. You've become the first blind electrical engineer student in the Southern Hemisphere. Just as a bit of background to you, Santiago, what's your secret? What's the key to that remarkable trajectory?
Honestly, I think it has to be my parents, the family, and something that I have been told time and time again by my parents. The only thing you can't do is see, but everything else. And I have used that through high school, university, and now my professional life to say barriers don't exist. We choose to put them there. And I tied that to my experiences with public transport, and I figured if I'm having these experiences, And if I can come up with a solution that benefits not just myself, but as you sort of said in your introduction, parents with prams, people who don't speak English, tourists, elderly people, and so on and so forth, the whole process just becomes a lot smoother.
So let's go back to the moment that this occurred to you. You missed the bus. What happened?
So I've been missing the bus for a long time, up until 2018, which is when sort of the breaking point occurred. But at that time, I was missing it to go out on dates, to meet with friends, and everybody was like, it's okay, it's not critical. But this particular time, I was going to uni, and I had an exam, and they don't sort of take it lightly when you don't show up on time. And I want to stress one thing. It wasn't the driver's fault. It was a very tricky stop where there were cars parked in front of it. There were trees. Even me calling the day before, as a lot of people do, and sort of having a high-vis vest and my guide dog by my side, they weren't going to see me. There wasn't anything that I could honestly do for them to see me. And I was left behind by three buses. And I thought, enough is enough. I can't have my life on pause because an infrastructure that we all rely on isn't working for me. And that's when I said, well, we have technology already on the vehicles that the government has already purchased. Why don't we just take advantage of it and enhance its capability and also make the drivers' lives easier? Because it's, I always like to say, when you go to the doctor, they do x-rays, they do MRIs, they know what they're getting themselves into before they cut into you. Drivers don't have that luxury.
You're listening to Santiago Velasquez, who's the creator of a Melbourne bus app that allows vision impaired, but also anyone else, to hail buses in real time. 1300 222 774. If you've had problems with accessibility of buses as well, Santiago. So you made this app. It's called Halo. How does it work?
It's quite simple. So Halo, you pull it up. You can see the bus stops, train stops, tram stops around you. At the moment, we are operating in the Ventura services, so this is the east of Melbourne. And then you pick which service you want to get on, you pick where you want to get off if you want, and you hit hail. And then the bus driver, as they are approaching your stop for pickup, they get an alert on their dashboard saying, please stop. And as they are approaching your destination, again, they get an alert to say somebody wants to get off. You get alerts throughout the whole process. And if you so choose, you can also disclose your access requirements. I, for example, I have a guide dog. I have friends that pick, they use wheelchairs. I have friends that are parents. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea is if we give drivers the ability to know what's coming ahead, they can angle the bus better for some stops that are tricky to deploy the ramp. They can stop for longer. It's just all about information. Mm.
And it seems so simple. It is at the moment only on Ventura bus services in Melbourne, and they're the ones across Melbourne's southeastern, eastern and northern suburbs. What are you learning? And it is just at the pilot stage. What are you learning from the pilot so far?
After 1 month, because we have only been live for about a month, we've been learning that people really, really like it. Drivers, they keep saying, I don't have to stress too much about what's coming ahead because I know. And 90% of our users do not have a disability. The disability community is loving it, and I love the support we have received from Guide Dogs Vision Australia, Blind Citizens Australia, and the Foundation, and other organizations. But most people, that just shoot us a message and say, hey, I'm tired after work and I just want to make my life a little bit easier, or I don't speak a word of English, or I don't know the city. And it's fascinating that when I first started, and when we first launched with Ventura, we originally thought the first month was going to be just people with disabilities. Mm. And then slowly but surely, the general public was going to catch on.
I love the idea of these delightful unintended consequences. I thought in particular your point about people who have to wait in the dark. It's just such a no-brainer in terms of security if you can let the bus driver know that you're there.
Absolutely. And again, I keep coming back to, our public transport networks are reactive nowadays. You don't exist until you step onto the vehicle. And because of that, planning in terms of the driver, what they need to do, but also long-term planning for the network itself, we are reacting to what has already happened rather than, okay, you have two people with a pram at this stop, you have one person with a wheelchair, you have... If we know that in advance, we can do magic in terms of utilization of resources and future allocation of trams, trains, buses. Mm. So it started from one, I guess, frustrating day where I felt like a second-class citizen. But long-term, we have a resource that is used by a lot of people. Why don't we just make it better?
So it's been going for a month. It's just on the Ventura Services line at the moment. How many people have got the app? Do you have that number?
I do, yes. At the moment, we have more than 1,200 users.
Okay.
And in a day, we are seeing about 140 to 150 hails per day, which means, depending on the hour, sometimes it can be as frequent as every 2 minutes somebody's doing a hail. So since we started, I have no doubt that a few people have made a couple of hails and have helped drivers.
And yeah, if they like it, they go back for more. If you have used Halo, 1300 222 774, give me a call. I'd love to hear why you used it, how it has changed your commute. And if you are, as Santiago is saying, not vision impaired, one of those many people in the community who are using it for all different sorts of reasons, let me know. If Jenny in Fitzroy has texted Santiago saying, this app sounds fabulous and thanks. Craig from Essendon has texted to say, the greatest challenge for my wife is purchasing appliances that now have digital readouts only and few options with a tactile service to feel a reference point. Santiago, I think I read you've been working on that sort of issue as well in the past. Is that right?
I have, yeah. This is a bit of an older company of mine where I couldn't interact with graphs and charts and things of that nature at university. So I started another company called iSight, which I'll admit it's a bit dormant, but basically it's a tactile display that when you look at it, you're looking at a tablet. So you're looking at Word, Excel, whatever. But when you touch the glass itself, you can feel the buttons, or you can feel Braille, or you can feel... basically, whatever you can see, you can feel. And I agree with Greg, it's frustrating to buy appliances where it's cheaper. So I can speak from the engineering standpoint, it's cheaper to manufacture things that don't have buttons. But it also means that the user experience becomes a lot more frustrating, not only for people who have a vision impairment, but for the general public. Sometimes you just want to hit a button and know that it worked.
Yeah. Well, Santiago, yes, so many challenges ahead, but you are someone also who has come up with a solution. So thank you so much for joining us and telling us all about it.
No, thank you, Mary. Thanks for having me. And for people who are out and about, if you're using public transport in Victoria, take Halo out for a spin. We'd love to see what we can do better to make your life more accessible.
There you go. If you are on the Ventura bus lines, do that. That is Santiago Velasquez, who is the inventor of that Halo app that's being piloted at the moment. As I said, someone wrote into me saying at conversationhour@abc.net.au, and I read it and we were looking into it because that email said, look, many people in the community are just not familiar with terms like low vision and legally blind. They don't know how to help people who are vision impaired in everyday situations. That's what got us onto this subject. So apart from anything else, write to me, tell me what else we should be looking at. Also, though, we wanted to talk about this with Chris Edwards, who is Chief Mission Officer at Vision Australia. And Chris himself is blind as a result of a condition called retinitis pigmentosa. Chris, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, Mary. Great to be here.
First, your response to the Halo app?
Look, I think that people who are blind or have low vision are heavily reliant, obviously, on public transport and because they don't drive themselves. And I certainly remember sitting beside the road, particularly on those streets where there's multiple different types of buses coming along, and knowing which way, is this the 507 or the 509 or whatever it is, and having a new system that can actually help flag to say, well, pull over when the 509 comes, is a really big advantage for for people who are blind and low vision.
Mm. 1300 222 774. If you've got a vision impairment, if someone in your life does, tell us about the challenges, tell us about the solutions as well, and what you'd like people to know. Before we get on to that, Chris, I do also wanted to ask you, in terms of public transport, this came in on text as Santiago was talking. What do you do about no tie downs for wheelchairs? What's the issue there, and what would you have to say to that texter?
Certainly, I think that, you know, there's various modes of transport, and as somebody in a wheelchair that is reliant on a tie down where it stops the wheelchair from flying forward if the bus brakes suddenly, these should be just basic features for all public transport.
You know, and they're not? Public,
yeah, no. Well, there's in some buses, this is just not there. And I think that, what we see is, whether it's in the tram network or there's still trams that aren't accessible to people in wheelchairs. We need to continue to strive better and to actually meet the promises of where governments say that they want to get to for accessibility.
Mm. To the texter who has asked, the app is spelled H-A-I-L-O, that's Halo. This is saying lots more will have downloaded Halo today. Thanks, not in my area, but still downloaded. So obviously, yes, there's a fair bit of need out there. Let me read you a little bit, Chris, of this email. I know that we've sent it to you. And it was saying, look, where lots of people are often unsure how to appropriately assist individuals who are vision impaired in everyday situation, and that can unintentionally lead to exclusion, reduced independence and social discomfort for those affected. What would you have to say about the level of awareness of what people can do if they see someone, for instance, with a white cane or a seeing eye dog?
Look, I think that it is a really big challenge for the public to go, okay, do I need to intervene or don't I? I think probably the first principle is that you can assume that most people are relatively independent. But if I'm in a tricky situation where I might be trying to cross a traffic light that's or a crossing that's particularly difficult, or having look like I'm a bit lost in going through a train station, there's no harm in actually just asking, is everything okay, can I help you? And so I think the principle is, don't assume that somebody needs help, but you can just ask them, and they'll be the best person to say, look, that'd be great, could you help me do this? Mm. Or, no, I'm fine, thank you.
Yeah, people just feel awkward sometimes too. I'm sure listening to you, people might feel a little bit braver. Julie's called in I beg your pardon. What were you about to say,
sorry.
Chris? No, yeah. Go ahead.
I have a basic rule of the ATP rule, which is ask the person, and and they're the best person to be able to guide you.
That's a really good rule. Julie has called in from Taylor's Hill. What did you want to say, Julie?
Hi, how are you?
Yeah, good, thank you.
I just want to say, when I heard about this app, even though my son doesn't have any vision impairments or disabilities or whatnot, I think it's a great idea. The fact that, say, for example, 10 times he's caught the bus trying to get to school in a neighbouring suburb, the bus has driven past him 3 times, and then he calls me frantically, my bus is late, I can't get to school on time, so forth, so forth. So I think it's a great idea to have something like that, to flag a bus down, to say that someone is waiting for that particular bus. And conversely, recently I had him trying to catch a bus home from Caroline Springs to home, and he said he called me frantically, standing in the dark in some side street, the bus is running late. He looked at the public transport app, it was running late. But if someone, if they knew that he was there, somehow the app could kind of signal automatically that if you want to catch that particular bus, that it's running late, rather than standing there worrying in the dark and so forth. And all this is compounded by the fact that there aren't enough bus services in this particular area. Mm. If you miss one bus, you have to wait 30 or 40 minutes to catch another one.
Yeah. Taylor's Hill, I'm wondering if that's on the Ventura bus line. I'm not quite sure.
No, it's not. I just had a look to see whether it actually services this area, and it's not. So if they could, do a trial in this area, that would be great, because I'm sure people would pick it up.
Julie, that's a really good point. And maybe letting the people responsible for this trial know. Of course, the Department of Transport is behind the Halo app. Yeah, it sounds like it is fulfilling a need well beyond the vision impaired community, Chris. Chris Edwards is with us, who is from Vision Australia. And we're talking about not just the Halo app, but other gaps in our public education as well when it comes to how we treat the people in the community who may have vision impairment as well. You were talking about people feeling free to walk up to someone if they feel that they might need assistance. What then? What would a person who is blind, who has low vision, want them to do in that case?
Yeah, I think that probably the other really important thing there too is that when we refer to someone who's blind, there's only about 10% of the people that have no vision. So 90% of people will have some vision, and there'll be people that use dogs, and there'll be people that use canes, and there'll be people that may not use anything and might just have a vision impaired badge or nothing. And so I think it's recognising that people will have different capability themselves. And so if someone does I'd love some support, the worst thing you can do is try and grab them by the arm and drag them. If you ever do that to yourself or get someone to do it to yourself, it feels very uncomfortable. But what blind people are very used to is a thing called sighted guide, which is simply being able to let them grab your arm, and they're very used to walking, with you to help to get that support. And so what I often do is when someone asks me for help, you say, oh, can I take your arm? And so, you can just simply offer, would you like to take my arm? And just walk normally, and they'll be able to help guide you in what works for them.
Chris, thank you so much for joining the conversation today. I'm sure that you've answered a lot of maybe unasked questions that people have in their minds, that moment of hesitation. Thank you.
No problem at all. Thanks, Mary, for having us.
That's Chris Edwards, who is Corporate Affairs and Chief Mission Officer at Vision Australia. And we were talking before that to Santiago Velasquez about the Halo app, again, spelled H-A-I-L-O. Also, Judy from Geelong says, as a vision impaired person, I'm constantly frustrated with how small toilet signs are. It's like they are a secret. And this is well on text. I have a daughter who's legally blind. She's fiercely independent, always used public transport. There have been changes. The signage at Richmond, Parliament and Flinders is now higher and has smaller print. The signage on trams also too small. So clearly many challenges. Luckily, there are people like Santiago and others who are coming up with solutions. Very soon, we are going to be talking about yet another shortage in HRT medicine. 1300 222 774, if you want to jump on the line to ask questions. We are going to get some advice as to what alternatives you might consider. A little bit later as well, we're going to be talking about what is happening in the Iran war. But coming up next, what's happening in Australian netball?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
Well, great news this morning for Melbourne Vixens. They've announced they've now reached the 10,000 members mark, which seems to break all sorts of records when it comes to professional women's sports, basically anywhere. At the same time, we know that Netball Australia recently announced a deficit for the first time in 4 years. We all love our netball. We all want it to survive, so we're invested. We want to know what's going on. What does it mean? To give us her thoughts on what's going on, the one and only Bianca Chatfield, former Diamonds player and sports commentator with Fox Sports, joins me now. Hi, Bianca.
Hi, how you going?
Very well, thank you. Not as well probably as the Vixens. Let's start there. 10,000 members. I was looking up, what membership in women's sports looks like. I think even WNBA teams that don't have that sort of membership kind of model, even then, 10,000 season tickets, for instance, is a big deal.
It is huge. And, obviously, that club has been built over many years, and back when I was playing for it, I remember us celebrating when I was really young and just entering in. I think we just got a milestone of 2,000 members, and that was enormous. And for us, that meant moving from, a state netball centre that could hold only 3,000 to then John Cain Arena being more of a home ground for the team. And so it has evolved significantly over the past, probably 10 years, I'd say, to get to this point. And so it's a huge win for Melbourne Vixens and Netball Victoria, because it's taken a lot of work behind the scenes to get it to this point. And now they've got a beautiful problem in that 10,000 people is almost over capacity what John Cain Arena can hold. So maybe Rod Laver Arena next.
Exactly. Stick one there. How does it compare to other clubs?
Well, I think that membership number for Vixens accounts for 25% of the entire league membership. So, they are significantly ahead. I know New South Wales Swifts do pretty well in terms of their numbers too. And we've got to remember, in Super Netball at the moment, you've got some clubs who've been in existence for quite a long time, and you've got clubs that have only come in recently too. So there is, a bit of discrepancy between the clubs in that aspect too and how long they've been around for. So Netball Victoria and Melbourne Vixens have, obviously had that advantage too, of being around for a long time.
You're listening to Bianca Chatfield. We're talking about the state of Australian netball, and the Vixens are going well. But as I mentioned, Bianca, there's that deficit that has been recently posted by Netball Australia. They've got a collective players agreement yet to negotiate. They've got a few things happening, haven't they?
Yeah, it's a big kind of year for netball. And I think it's, off the back of, for the Diamonds, they've got the Comm Games and a home World Cup coming up next year as well in Sydney. So that's one big thing that has to be coordinated, and I know will be a huge success. And then on the Super Netball front, there's a new broadcast deal. Obviously, once that happens, there's also a players agreement that has to happen and a teams participation agreement that has to happen. So there's a lot that has to go on behind the scenes, and a lot of things that have to align over the next probably, I think, few months to then put it forward what the next couple of years will look like in netball.
So we'll pick that apart in a moment, but at the same time, they still haven't got a CEO, is that right?
No. Well, they've got an interim CEO at the moment.
Right. Okay, so there is someone at the helm.
Definitely.
That broadcast deal is a good deal, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know a huge amount about the details yet, but obviously netball was on Nine 5 years ago, and I think it's come such a long way since being on Fox. And, we never used to have long pre-games. We never used to have magazine shows that went with the coverage. So, I think with what's happened at Fox, and of course I'm biased because I work there, but we've been able to do more and more with the game and showcase, I think, more of the players as well. So hopefully that continues on as it moves across to Nine next year.
Recently, Bianca, you were on with the great Lisa Alexander talking about on a podcast, Code Netball Show. I should give it a due note. And she was saying that she was worried that netball is expanding. It's the perennial, right? Is netball expanding and pushing themselves too much, spreading itself too thin with priorities? What's your point of view?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that there's a lot of layers to that too. Like, in some aspects, I think we have to think big and look into the future about what we can do and what it could look like. And so that might mean taking a few risks, but obviously you want those to be quite educated risks. And in other ways, I think we have to make sure we've got some really strong, solid foundations too, and we keep building on that before we progress too far. But from memory, I think Lisa was talking about maybe expansion and adding new teams into Super Netball. I would love to see that too, but I think we have to make sure it's at the right time and when the sport can afford it to happen.
What are you enjoying most in the Super Netball at the moment, Bianca?
Oh, well, I think the Melbourne Vixens especially, they're undefeated right now, and Adelaide Thunderbirds have only dropped one. So those two teams are storming ahead. Hard to believe that we're in the second half of the season now, but some big games to come. And Melbourne, the grand final is in Melbourne, so no doubt the Melbourne Vixens will want to get themselves in that to hopefully repeat what happened last year.
Get onto that 10,000 plus membership list. Bianca Chatfield, thank you. It's always great to talk to you.
No problems. Thank you.
Bianca is, of course, the former Diamonds player, legend of netball and sports commentator with Fox Sports. Earlier this hour, we were talking about vision impairment and the Halo app, and it's the person who was behind it, Santiago. Someone says the problem is that you have to have a smartphone. Yes, I guess that's the problem with a lot of things. This on text as well: I'm in a wheelchair and have tipped over sideways with my head up against the window because they don't have tie downs in public buses like they do in maxi taxis. It's too dangerous. Nico, of another text there. Also, next coming up, we have got HRT. I'm asking you, have you had a problem accessing your HRT patches? And why are we talking about that again?
On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria.
This is The Conversation Hour.
You're with Mary Guerin.
It's 24 minutes to 12. Well, why are we having this discussion again? I don't know. Maybe my next guest can tell me. Dr. Terry Foran is a board member of the Australasian Menopause Society and is a sexual health physician. Thanks for joining us, Terry.
It's a pleasure, Mary.
I don't know why this seems to be a constant news story, but it is very important to a lot of people. So that's why we're talking about it today. More shortages. Why?
Well, this has been happening since about 2020. And it's sort of like whole things coming together to be a problem. And nobody seems to be able to sort of see an end to it. The first thing is that the stuff that these are made of, soy, has to be transported across long distances before it's manufactured in Europe. So things like COVID made a huge difference to that, and I suspect we're also seeing that happen at the moment with ships tied up. The other thing is that it's fairly complicated to make a patch. I mean, making a cream or a tablet is a relatively easy thing to do, and there are lots and lots of factories that are sort of tooled up to do that. Patches are complicated. They have plastics, they have membranes across that mean you don't get the whole patch dose in one day. So they're expensive to make. There's not much of a profit margin. And, you know, only small numbers of places make them. So, and then,
yes.
Oh, I'll go on, Mary. No. And then it got worse because more and more people started to use them. Okay, so doctors preferred to give them as a first choice. We saw increases in women who were interested in menopausal hormone therapy. And the whole thing just became a huge issue.
So a lot of demand, they're complicated, and then there's the war. We will get into what's happening in the war as well to round out this hour. So it has been confusing. Stick around for that update. But Terry, what does that mean in the medium term then? Sure, we've got these problems now. Into the medium and longer term, are we going to get over it, and when?
I hope we are, because, you know, that's the logical thing to happen. The when's more tricky. From a doctor's perspective, we have at the Australasian Menopause Society a little update that we give out to doctors to tell them when these patches are likely to be available and what doses they're available in. But it's like it keeps kicking a can up the road. Every time we contact them, it's another 3 months, you know, and that's been going for a very long time. The companies know that there's a problem, and they have promised to try and up their supply, and I'm hoping that we get at least some of these in the short-term future, because that's what we're hearing. But I hate to promise, because I've done that before to my patients, and, you know, 2 years later, we're still waiting.
TBC, 1300 222 774. If you've been caught out by this, what have you done? What has been your solutions? We're hearing about people travelling interstate. We're hearing about cutting patches in half. Is that you? 1300 222 774, the number to call, or text 0437 774 774 if you've got a question for Dr. Terry Foran, who is from the Australasian Menopause Society and is a sexual health physician. You can ask her, 1300 222 774. What do you think about these reports about women cutting their menopause patches in half? Is that a good idea?
It's certainly okay to do that. The patches that aren't as commonly used, so the very high dose and the very low dose, tend to be around a bit more than the ones that are commonly used.
Can you say that again? The ones that are higher?
The ones that are more commonly used are the middle doses.
Right.
Very high doses, very low doses aren't commonly used. So there tend to be more of them out there in the supply chain.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, they've been around. Now, you could use a number of the smaller patches to add up to the one you need. The trouble is that's an expensive option. So most women prefer to take one of the larger patches and cut it in half. You can do that with estrogen alone patches. It's much trickier to do with the patches that contain both estrogen and progestogen, and we don't tend to recommend that.
Why is it trickier?
Well, they're distributed differently throughout the patch, so it's harder to get the right dose by doing that. If you've got a patch that delivers just one hormone and you cut it in half, you're going to get half that hormone. But in a patch that delivers both, they have different reservoirs, if you like, within the patch, and you might not be able to get the right dose that way.
Oh, that's interesting. So just if someone's listening and they're asking themselves, wouldn't that just even out in the end if you get a bit more of one hormone one, I guess, week or, you know, and then in the next week the rest? I'm not trying to say that that's a good idea, Terry. I'm just anticipating what people might ask.
I think it's a really good question because it seems logical. Mm. The trouble is that if you get too much estrogen, you tend to get more side effects, things like bloating and nausea and things like that. That's annoying but not dangerous. If you don't get enough progestogen, the other side of the picture, then that allows the lining of the uterus to build up more than it should, and that can lead to bleeding and, you know, it's unlikely to cause any trouble short term, but that's really, really, really annoying.
Also, this idea of travelling interstate, why would people be doing that, Terry?
I think it's simply because different states have different usage patterns, so it's sometimes easier to pick something up from a state which possibly doesn't, you know, have the same usage pattern that maybe somewhere like inner city Melbourne does or inner city Sydney.
People ringing ahead or ringing around and trying to find it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I have patients who, you know, a month before they run out of patches will actually ring around all the local chemists. And one of my patients has gone many, many kilometres, you know, said, you know, hold that pack for me and I'll be there, and travelled out. So, you know, it's almost like it's contraband, you know. People are travelling forever to get their right patches. Most people don't do that. Most people will speak to their pharmacist and, you know, the pharmacist will discuss alternatives. And that sounds okay, but often a patch is used because it's convenient. You only have to use twice a week, and most of the alternatives are daily, so that's, you know, an added thing into the mix. It's not quite so convenient. And the other thing is sometimes even an alternative patch, which we have had available, may not give the person the same relief, may not stick as well to the skin, may be bigger or more intrusive. So it's not as easy as it sounds. Mm. Certainly one of my beefs with the government is, you know, just prescribe an alternative. And that's really not easy.
It's not as easy as it sounds. Yeah.
No, it's not easy for the pharmacist. It's not easy for the doctors who have to sort of sort out alternatives, you know, short term, long term. It's really been a situation that's been incredibly frustrating for the best part of the last 6 years.
You're listening to Terry Foran. We're talking about the ongoing recurring shortages of HRT patches. Terry, there's also been some reporting in the ABC about someone who was told, you know, yes, you can't get your preferred brand. She tried the alternative that the pharmacist had, the only one that was available, and it left her with a rash. Is that common, just to swap brands and get that sort of side effect?
Well, that's what everybody's been doing. The recommendation is, you know, if you can't get what you've been using, try the alternative medication that's in the same dose. But as I was saying before, it's a bit like the old ad, you know, patches, you know, aren't all patches. They use different glues. So some patches might not cause a reaction on the skin, others may. One of the complaints that my patients have is that they don't stick as well. And, you know, that's an individual thing. People have, you know, different sweat levels, different skins, that sort of thing. So if they don't stick well, they don't deliver the drug. You can't just sort of, you know, stick them on with a bit of, you know, tape or something like that and hope that that gets it in there. They need to stick to deliver the drug. So one of my patients complains that, you know, it doesn't stick very well, and that means that she gets her symptoms back. So no, it's not quite as easy as it sounds, and sometimes it's even better to go to a completely different alternative if that's safe.
Right.
So you might go to, you know, an oral medication. You might go to a gel rather than the patch, and, you know, just wait around until the patch becomes easier to get. I certainly think travelling interstate is probably, you know, I think there are better alternatives would be my message. I think that there are things that might suit someone better than, you know, having to get on a plane and get it.
Yeah, indeed, especially not on the roads because you can't afford it. Terry, what I mean, you're saying, look, try all these other things. Your advice to people would be obviously to talk to your GP first. Is that right?
Yep, it would be. Look, if it's just a question of swapping the patch, then the pharmacist can do that. You know, if somebody's just wants another brand or is okay to try another brand, the pharmacist can do that for them. They can give an alternative preparation. If that doesn't work, then the doctor is definitely the next port of call because there are other alternatives that might suit you better.
This on text, Terry, from Sharon. Please discuss a tablet versus a patch.
Well, excuse me, frog in throat. Look, the story is that the patches deliver via the skin, and that means that they don't have the risk of clots in the legs or the lungs that the oral medications do. And that's the reason why doctors all across the world have preferred to prescribe these as their first choice, either a patch or a gel.
Hence the demand.
Hence the demand. The reality, though, is that if you're 50, then the risk of a clot in the leg or the lung is really, really, really low, unless you have identifiable risk factors, and doctors are able to pick those up. So for some women, an alternative to the patch being hard to get is simply to take an oral medication. But it does need individualisation. For example, if you've got a history of heart disease or a family history if you've got a family history of heart disease or you're on the heavier side or you get migraines with aura, there might be reasons why a patch is a really better idea for you than a tablet. But, you know, tablets served us well for many years, and it's certainly an alternative for most healthy young women in their 50s.
You're on 774 ABC Melbourne and Victoria. We are talking about the shortages ongoing of HRT patches. Kim, you're in Richmond. What did you want to say?
Yes, this shortage of patches, I thought it was just a COVID thing, but in fact it's carried on, and the patch that I used has now become not available, and I was given an alternative that just didn't work for me. I was having terrible nights and then migraines afterwards. It just wasn't working. And then I worked out that actually my girlfriend's, one of my girlfriends very kindly had in the back of her had a similar situation, and from COVID, leftover of COVID, she had one that she used to cut up that was my strength, and she had it in the back of her cupboard, and I ran around to her house and got it from the back of her cupboard. And it's like almost we need a WhatsApp group as to who's got what patches left over in the back of their cupboard so we can do a swap. I mean, it's crazy.
Kim, how many does she have stashed away? Is it enough for you?
I'm going to start a Facebook group on, hormonepatches.com. It will be a raging success.
I love it, Kim.
People swapping their patches because we can't get it at the pharmacy, but people have got so many stored ones that they're not using. They used to cut up and swap. It's madness. I don't understand why we can't have a regular supply.
Oh, Kim, that is a terrific idea. The raging HRT Facebook, I want to see it up there soon. What do you reckon, Terry? Is it all coming down to just cooperation?
Hottest one in town, I suspect. Just as a doctor, I have to be a little dampener to that. You need to also make sure that any drug you use is within its expiry date. Now, these have long expiry dates, but just be sure that you check that. Otherwise, it may not work as well as it should.
Yes, even as you're raiding your friends' wardrobes and slapping them on your arms, maybe just check it with your doctor. Terry, thank you so much for talking to us today and explaining it all again.
It's an absolute pleasure, Mary. Look, I just hope that, hopefully things will change so that, this becomes a non-issue. It really should be a non-issue. And I guess it goes to being on the end of supply chains on the other side of the world.
Indeed.
We do tend to be the last one served. So let's hope that changes.
Yes, we are about to talk about Iran and all of these. That is just one of the dominoes that has fallen from the Middle East. But Terry, thank you so much for joining us today. Dr. Terry Foran, who is board member of the Australasian Menopause Society and is a sexual health physician. Similar to Kim, this has come in on text. Are people running around to find patches? I live in Bendigo and frequently buy for Melbourne friends, but it's just women's healthcare, so who cares, right? That on text. Well, it is 10 minutes to 12. And as I've been saying, there's HRT patches. that's just one of the effects of what's happening in the Middle East. And you might be a bit confused. Over the past few hours, a couple of things happened. The Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, said the ceasefire is holding, but then the US President announced that Project Freedom, that's the project supposed to open the Strait of Hormuz, is paused for more peace talks, but the blockade remains. Are you confused? If so, you're not alone. Here to explain for us is Dr. Jessica Genauer, who is global conflict expert at the University of New South Wales. Thank you so much for joining us, Jessica.
My pleasure.
So can you explain for those who haven't been watching this, you know, every single thing coming out and having to parse somewhat contradictory headlines, what's been happening over the past few hours?
Definitely. So first of all, this is legitimately quite confusing, and that's partly because of President Trump's style and approach, where he tends to sort of make particular threats or say that he's going to engage in a certain action, but then sort of sees how it goes and often pivots quite quickly when he sees that it hasn't quite gone, you know, as successfully as he might have liked. So the big broad picture in terms of the Iran war at the moment is that there is still this kind of somewhat shaky ceasefire, but certainly a ceasefire that is holding. And I actually do expect that to continue to hold, because President Trump doesn't really want to go back to full-scale military combat with Iran, and the Iranian regime also doesn't want that to happen. So that's kind of the bigger picture. But more, yeah.
No. And yet I was just about to say there is this stalemate. So how does it end?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So more specifically, when we look at the Strait of Hormuz, which is a key sticking point now, I mean, there's the whole nuclear issue as well, which has certainly not been resolved. But the really clear and present flashpoint is around the Strait of Hormuz, where we still have US warships kind of sitting at the mouth of the Strait of Hormuz in the Gulf of Oman. We have, of course, the Iranian regime that has the ability to be quite active in the Strait of Hormuz in terms of attacking ships and et cetera, if they choose to do so. So it's really a bit of a standoff between the US and the Iranian regime, and neither side quite has a good solution for how they can get complete control over the Strait. And so we saw President Trump say, okay, I'm going to engage in this Operation Freedom, which means essentially the US is going to somehow accompany ships to go in and out of the Strait. Now, what happened was they started that operation. They accompanied two US ships out of US flagged, you know, merchant vessels out of the Strait of Hormuz. But what happened was, I think that they then saw that it was not only very sort of complicated, but also very risky type of operation. So there were apparently US military personnel that were on board those merchant ships. But during that passage, they shot at apparently six small boats in the Strait of Hormuz with some loss of life. And the problem is that the Strait of Hormuz is full of small boats going up and down and across all of the time that are usually civilians. But there's always that chance that there might be a risk that they do have some kind of malicious intent towards a US merchant vessel. So probably the US military, if they're trying to accompany ships in and out, are going to be more likely to shoot first and ask questions later, which will create all kinds of complexities and problems and potentially threat to civilian life of fisher people and other types of folks, you know, going about their business in small boats in the Strait of Hormuz. So I think Trump saw that this was going to be really complicated and then said, okay, this is on hold, but we're still waiting for the Iranian regime to give us some kind of proposal that we can accept in terms of extending the ceasefire.
Yeah. You're listening to Jessica Genauer, who's a global conflict expert at University of New South Wales. We're talking about what is happening in the Strait of Hormuz. You were talking there about it being such a dangerous situation and not really wanting to be part of it. At the same time, we've got the US Secretary of War, Pete Hegseth, who in the past few hours repeated that call out on other countries to help, including Australia. Let's have a little listen.
We hope South Korea would step up, just like we hope Japan would step up, just like we hope Australia would step up, just like we hope Europe steps up. But we're not waiting for them to do so. We're looking to set the conditions to hand to them.
Jessica, what do you think about the risks of Australia even being part of it at this point in time?
So it would be very risky, like until such time as there's actually a more permanent ceasefire or some real change in terms of the very sort of high risk situation at the moment in the Strait of Hormuz. So essentially there needs to be some kind of agreement from the Iranian regime that they are letting foreign actors into the Strait of Hormuz without saying that they're going to attack them on site. You know, if without withstanding that situation, I would say it is not advisable for Australia to get involved. Also, the Trump administration has really gone about this in a way that, of course, they didn't pre-consult any of their security allies or partners around the world. So it's not something that Australia sort of agreed to and then backed out. We never sort of agreed to go into a war with Iran. And I don't think it would be wise for us to do so now. And I think we can see that from US traditional security partners and allies all around the world who are similarly reticent to get involved. And I think there's some frustration in that regard from the Trump administration. But I think what they're learning is you do need to consult with people before you act if you then want them to buy into your military operation once it takes place.
I know this is an impossible question, but I'm going to ask it anyway, Jessica. If you had to have an educated guess about how long this standoff will happen, until one side or the other, or possibly both, declare victory, what would you say?
Yeah, so I certainly don't see the Iranian regime, as long as they're still in control of Iran, and it doesn't look like they'll collapse anytime soon. I'd say there's at least a sort of 5 to 10 year timeline on any kind of internal fractures that might bring about some sort of collapse of that regime. So they will firmly stay in place in the meantime. And as long as they're in place, they will not give up control over the Strait of Hormuz because, you know, that's just their geography. They're right there. They need it.
So they can wait it out.
They can wait this out, essentially, although it is creating economic costs for them for sure, but they will wait it out because they don't necessarily have a choice. And they're definitely not going to give over control of the Strait of Hormuz to the US.
So maybe months?
I would say definitely we're looking at months of probably this standoff in the Strait of Hormuz, tit for tat. Unfortunately, that means disruptions to global shipping, which affects supply chains, as you were just talking about in your previous story, also affects fuel prices, fertilizers, etc. So yes, I'd say at least months, if not till the end of this year, we might see some sort of standoff without a complete resolution of free flow of shipping in and out of the Strait of Hormuz.
Jessica, thank you for answering the impossible questions.
Thanks for having me on the program.
Jessica Gnauer is Director of the Public Policy Institute at New University of New South Wales. Thank you so much for joining me today. And as we heard, we do read those emails. Write to me, conversationhour@abc.net.au. If you'd like us to cover anything, any suggestions of stories, I'd love to hear it. Have a wonderful day. If you'd like to listen to this again, it's on the ABC Listen app. Talk tomorrow.